and then the light just phenomenal.
Well, what about spa robes and little paw slippers?
My son has spa robes for both of his French bulldogs.
Oh my God!
We were just kidding. About
yeah,
that.
We were.
Oh no.
Hello, everyone. It's the Two Boomer Babes.
Hey, Barb. Do you ever wonder why some people who seem to have everything cheat on their spouse?
Yeah, but I wonder how on earth do they find the time or even have the energy?
A relationship expert tells us why and how to move forward.
Next, a father talks about helping his teenage son come to terms with his sexuality.
Then, a behind-the-scenes look at calling elections for a major television network.
And pampered pets, how hotels are catering to their every need.
When powerful men like General David Petraeus cheat, it leaves us babes wondering why. They jeopardize their careers and reputations, not to mention their marriages.
Psychologist and research scientist at the University of Michigan, Dr. Terry Orbach, directed a landmark 25-year study of marriage, divorce, and repartnering. She maintains that powerful men are especially vulnerable to cheating.
Dr. Orbach joins us from Detroit to tell us why men cheat and how it's 100% possible to find love again when relationships fail. Welcome to the show, Terry.
Thank you for having me.
Why do powerful men cheat when the stakes are so high if they get caught?
Yes, and the stakes are really high. I should first acknowledge, though, that both men and women cheat of all statures, ages, and races, and not all powerful men have affairs. So I just want to say that at the beginning. But as you mentioned, I do believe that powerful men are especially vulnerable to some common traps that jeopardize their marriages. So first, I think powerful men cheat because there's the illusion of invulnerability. I call it the Superman phenomenon. They have an affair because they think they can and they won't get caught. They have the resources to sort of cover it up, or they have the people around them that will help them not get caught.
But don't they realize there's this little thing that was invented a few years ago called the internet and cell phone cameras?
Yeah.
I mean, how could they think they wouldn't get caught? They're in the public eye.
Well, I think they're not thinking about the long-term effects of their actions, or even that they might get caught. They're really short-term related. They're only thinking about the present, and they have these goals of another relationship, and that's what they're sort of blinded by.
They must have some terrific time management skills or a great scheduler on the side, because I can't imagine how they squeeze it in. How do you squeeze in a sneaky love affair with all they have to do?
We don't even have time to go to the grocery store, Terry.
That's right. Or take a bathroom break.
I agree with you. Well, I think two things are happening. First, they have the people around them that help them manage their time. I'm convinced that when we're talking about powerful men, people in the surrounding part or organization or group know what's going on. They're just covering it up for that powerful male. And I think second, powerful men, or many powerful men, are really sort of addicted to that adrenaline rush. So yes, they're doing a lot of things. They're performing well under high stress, but they continually need and enjoy the extra challenge or the extra excitement to, you know, be satisfied with their lives.
Do these relationships last? I mean, how on earth can a woman who this guy cheated with ever trust him again? I mean, after all, he's a cheater.
I think the biggest predictor of future behavior in a relationship is present behavior. So if you're having a relationship with someone who has cheated and with you, there's a high likelihood that you are going to experience some similar betrayal. It may not be infidelity itself, but it probably is going to be a similar kind of betrayal where trust is broken. It may not be an affair, but it may be lying about money or time management. And so I really think people want to examine, when they get in a new relationship, the prior or past behaviors of that current partner.
And I would think that would be really stressful, because even if they're not cheating, I would be so suspicious of everything they're doing.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think when trust is broken, there is the likelihood that that person person will break trust again. And we know that trust is such an essential and really vital part of any romantic relationship. And once it's broken, it's so difficult and hard to rebuild that trust and really trust that person again. So I completely agree with you 100%. Now, I think when powerful men, though, are having affairs, they're, you know, a male in general, and for all people, an affair signals an internal need for change. So any time an affair occurs or a betrayal occurs, something's not going right for that individual. They may not be happy with their current life. They may be bored, or something's going on in the relationship. So we can't forget that even for powerful men, there may be something going on in the relationship with their spouse.
Let's talk about the spouse that does stick with the marriage after an affair's happened. Can love be restored? Can the marriage survive?
We know that love can be restored, trust can be rebuilt, but it only occurs in about 1 out of 4 couples. So in 25% of situations, trust and love can be restored, but it's very difficult and very challenging to do that because, first of all, both partners need to be on the same page. They have to both want to rebuild the trust, and that can be difficult because in most situations, one person may want to rebuild the trust and the other doesn't, or they're just out of sync in when they want to rebuild that trust. Second, it's hard, as we know, as both of you were saying, to sort of trust someone again and really remember all the positive things that have occurred in a relationship in the past. And third, you may be able to forgive your partner, but you probably can't forget what happened. So along the way, you're going to be reminded and you're going to remember what happened. And that leads to anger, that leads to frustration, and that leads to a lot of questions and mistrustful behaviors and processes in a relationship.
This is Barb and Kathy, the Two Boomer Babes, and we are talking to relationship expert Dr. Terry Orbach about why men cheat and how to find love again after the breakup. Terry, you know, you were just saying about how some women want to repair their relationship or men want to repair their relationship after the spouses cheat. But do you think there's a practical side to that, too? Because, you know, for a lot of women especially, there's a financial consideration. I mean, maybe many women can't afford, maybe, you know, a very famous person, they have a lot of money, they can afford to live on their own. They're going to get a great divorce settlement. But, you know, there's kids involved, there's finances. You know, there's a whole practical side of it, which I think is a reason why a lot of women that aren't in the news do stay with their spouses, don't you think?
I think we need to remember that people are in relationships or they stay in relationships, only one reason is that they're happy. And so people can be unhappy in a relationship and still stay. And so they may stay because of the consequences of leaving. Like you said, there are children, there's a business, they can't afford to leave. What will their parents or friends or other family members think? And second, I think people stay even when they're unhappy because of moral or ethical or religious reasons. I took this marital vow, and no matter what happens, I will stay. So people stay because they're happy, but people stay also in relationships when they're unhappy.
Well, let's switch gears and talk about the individual that decides to dump the cheater and move on. And how do they really go about finding love again? Getting out there, finding a new partner. I mean, that's really got to be quite challenging.
And learning to trust again.
Exactly.
Well, it is challenging, very challenging. And in my new book, Finding Love Again, 6 Simple Steps to a New and Happy Relationship, I have been following the same divorced singles now for over 26 years. And what I found is that it is possible after divorce to find new love. 71% of the divorced singles that I've been following actually found new love, healthy new love again. The most important thing I think, Kathy and Barb, is that you need to let go of the past. and very hard to do. But those divorced singles who said, I don't feel much of anything for my ex-spouse, I'm almost emotionally neutral, I don't feel anger anymore, and I'm not pining away for my ex-partner, we're significantly more likely to find new love again. And second, most importantly, you want to be hopeful and optimistic. I also found that divorced singles who were optimistic, positive, and hopeful that they truly would find new love again, were significantly more likely
but
to find love.
Not to play the devil's advocate, actually.
She loves to do that. That's
I love
her
it. I love
role.
It. That's my job. Well, isn't it important to really spend some time mourning, eat 10 gallons of ice cream, you know, mourn the loss of your partner to really understand what went wrong so you don't make the same mistake the second time around or the third time or the fourth?
I agree with you. I do think you need to spend some time examining your prior relationship, examining what went wrong. But for some people, that occurs while they're still married. They emotionally separate with their current partner or spouse, and by the time the divorce occurs or physical separation occurs, they are immediately ready to find new love again because they've been processing and looking at the patterns and going into counseling for many months, many years. But for other people, it takes the physical separation or the divorce, and then they mourn, they step back, they think, they analyze, and it takes them a period of time before they are ready to get back out there. I think the question really is, when are you ready to love and really trust a new partner again?
Well, and I really enjoyed you wrote about adding some newness to our lives to kind of shake things up a bit in 21 days. So
yes.
How does that work? It's a, you know, we want to hear about that one.
Well, when I looked at the divorced singles, I found that those singles who actually changed one simple behavior for 3 weeks after the divorce were significantly more likely to find new love again. And what they said was, I cut the number of hours that I worked. I went to the gym once a day. I went out for lunch rather than ate lunch at my desk. So these were simple behaviors. And what they did was they made sure they were doing it for 3 weeks, 21 days. And what happened is they got out of their daily rut or habits. They changed their routine so much that they met new people, experienced new things, and got out of the boredom or habitual same old that they were doing after the divorce. And what happens then is you meet new people, you add some excitement to your life, and you're much more positive and hopeful about your future and finding new love again.
Relationship psychologist Dr. Terry Orbach and author of Finding Love Again, you've certainly given us a lot to think about. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, a father's story about his son's coming out. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
In the spring of 2009, John Schwartz received a phone call that is every parent's worst nightmare. His 13-year-old son, Joe, was on his way to the hospital. He had attempted suicide. Joe had just come out to his classmates, and it didn't go well.
In the memoir Oddly Normal, Joe's father chronicles his family struggles to help their teenage son come to terms with his sexuality in a sometimes hostile world. John Schwartz is a national correspondent for the New York Times. He joins us on the phone from New York City. John, a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thanks very much.
John, did you know your son was gay the day he decided to come out?
Oh, sure. I mean, we had known for years, and we had thought sort of, well, maybe since he was a little boy. It's not the sort of thing that you're certain of, but he threw off plenty of clues and signals, and we just sort of watched him grow up and thought, well, this is interesting.
John, did you know he was going to come out on that particular day to his classmates?
Well, he had come out to me a few weeks before, and he had told me that he was dropping hints to kids at school, had been dropping hints to kids at school. So I had a very strong feeling that things were about to start happening at school, and he was going to get more and more open about it.
John, let's go back in time and talk about the genesis of this whole thing. You say that you suspected from a very early age that Joe might be gay. What were some of the things that you were seeing?
Well, of course, you know, this sounds like I'm engaging in stereotypes. There are plenty of people who grow up, turn out to be gay, who don't have very effeminate childhoods. That is not Joe. Joe was the kid who, at the age of 3, was running around the house in a feather boa, and he loved to play dress-up. He had an older brother who was very, very brawny, and he liked to, do Halloween in a dress. But when Sammy was in a dress, the older brother, it was Sammy in a dress. It was a joke, and everybody was in on the gag. With Joe, there was a real love of dressing up, wearing the spangly tops, and he would say to Jean, my wife, and say, do I look like a disco yeti?
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And he just, you know, I mean, there was a real, not gender confusion so much as just a kid who was throwing off all kinds of clues. And again, it doesn't, lots of kids have effeminate childhoods, grow up effeminate and don't turn out to be gay. Again, that was not Joe. And as time went on, this sort of feeling we had that, oh, this kid could turn out to be gay turned out to be very true.
Well, did you and Gene discourage his choice of toys and try to steer him towards, the more boyish things like trucks and action figures?
Well, we
swords.
Never did. Yeah, we never, in terms of what he wanted to do, we wanted Joe to grow up being Joe. And we didn't care which way he turned as long as he was healthy and happy. And so we raised 3 kids. Joe was the youngest of the 3. We'd always had this big stack of toys in the living room that was trucks and Barbies, and all the other stuff. And the big sister, Elizabeth, when she was little, crawled over to that stack and pulled out all the Barbies. And Sammy, the next kid, comes along a few years later, and he goes over to the same stack. And the only reason he would touch the Barbies was to move them aside so that he could get to the trucks, unless he was running over Barbies with trucks, which was a phase. And then Joseph comes along, makes his way to the stack, and pushes aside the trucks to get to the Barbies and dresses them. And his play with Jean was to sit on the floor and dress the Barbies. And as Jean said, Barbie never looked so fabulous.
Wow, I bet. Well, but then he goes off to school, and Jean hides his Barbies. She puts them in
exactly.
The attic.
Yeah.
And did she do that because she was kind of worried when it came time for show and tell that might be what he would bring to school?
That is exactly it. This is not like telling a kid, you can't play with this because you should be this way. This was Jean's attempt to sort of gently put these out of sight so that Joe wouldn't show up, bring Barbies to show and tell, talk about how this layering and this and these clothes worked in this particular way and why they looked so good. She was afraid that he would end up getting ridiculed and felt bad about it at the time and felt terrible about it afterwards. Essentially, we built his first closet, and we realized that you can't stifle a kid like that.
Well, let's talk about school, because that was a really difficult place for Joe, and he had trouble fitting in with his peers. He had a lot of behavioral issues in the classroom, and in fact, didn't some teachers and therapists think he was pretty disturbed?
Yes, especially as, depending on the teacher, in years with good teachers, in years with teachers who got him, Joe was terrific and had a great time. In years where there were some teachers who were not just didn't get him, but were mean to him, were bullies, sort of vicious bullies. And in those years, Joe's reaction was very extreme. His behavior was awful, and his behavior could be troubling in the years in between. And so the school told us that they were worried about Joe. The teachers came to us with a litany of complaints and suggestions that perhaps he needed therapy. We got him therapy at various times. and to help him deal with behavior issues. But what we found was, again, in years with teachers who were supportive and flexible, he had great years. His behavior was very good. And but when you push this kid, he's going to push back, and it could be awful.
Well, he sounds like he was a very creative kid, so he could be a challenging student anyway.
Well, those kids can be, and Joseph was also dealing with a sort of two-level issue, because as we got testing for him from fourth grade on, we discovered that he was in a classification that they called GTLD. He was gifted and talented on the one hand, but learning disabled on the other.
John,
so
let me just stop you there. We have to take a break, but when we come back, more with New York Times national correspondent John Schwartz, author of the new memoir, Oddly Normal. Stay with us.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day I wake up...
For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is Kathy and Barb, the Two Boomer Babes. We're continuing our discussion with John Schwartz about his son's struggle to come to terms with his sexuality. John is the author of the book, Oddly Normal. John, why were you and your wife, Jean, so reluctant to have Joe labeled with any sort of disorder? I mean, in hindsight, would it have been helpful to get to the bottom of issues so you could really kind of begin to address them?
The school was giving us conflicting labels, and therapists were all over the place. Ultimately, Joe did end up with an IEP, individual education plan. He did get a diagnosis in the hospital that was PDD-NOS, a developmental disorder not otherwise specified. It was useful in getting him the kind of behavioral accommodations in school. So it's not like we were always resisting. What we were resisting were labels that didn't fit. People would say this, a psychologist or a teacher would say, this looks like ADHD. The teacher said ADHD. A psychologist said, this looks like Asperger's. And we would say, well, where is the part of that description of this that actually fits Joe? Because we see so many differences. And so we were resistant to mislabeling. We were reluctant to use medications unless we had a better sense of what was going on with him. Ultimately, as Joe came out, as Joe became more comfortable with who he is, as Joe relaxed, many of the behaviors that people were trying to hang a diagnosis on dissipated. And as he became a happier person, he became a healthier person. And so it seemed to us that there was an eagerness to jump to labels when dealing with Joe as a whole kid ended up getting us better results.
John, how did things change? So Joe came out to his friends, and as we said, it didn't go well. How did things change after the suicide attempt?
See, that's the good story. And that's the story that's really important here, because once Joe was out, all of a sudden, here's a kid who we can start saying, look, there are all these opportunities for you. There are all these programs that you can be involved in. And there's a gay center in New York City which has youth programs where you can get weekly discussion sessions with other kids and talk about their problems, your issues. We can send you to that program's week-long summer camp, which is both fun and therapy. We can get you involved. You know, when you get to high school, there's a GSA. And all of a sudden, Joe, who, when he was closeted, felt that he was alone, saw that he was part of a community and could take part in it. And as all those things happened, here's a guy who starts to become more comfortable in his own skin. And that made all the difference. Even something as simple as going to theater camp was a huge deal for him. And it's not just New York. It's not just because we live in New York that there are all these services available. I gave a talk a couple of weeks ago in Austin, and someone stood up and said, you know, we have a very good program for kids here in Austin, and we have a camp too. So it's not just you snooty New York types. Well, I grew up in Texas, okay, so I'm not snooty about it. But it was great to know that this is happening in lots of places.
John, what advice do you give for parents who think their child might be gay? Should you confront, or should you just let it come out when it comes out and when the child's ready?
Yeah, you know, this is something. When we were waiting for Joe, and we felt that the act of being closeted was was causing him pressure, internal pressure that he was suffering. We really wondered, and we've got lots of gay friends, and I consulted various friends who Gene and I referred to as the group of gay uncles, the League of Gay Uncles. And I just said, what would you have wanted your parents to do? Would you have wanted them to confront you, to push you a little bit? And they said, oh, God, no, don't do that. This is his secret, and he'll reveal it when he's ready. Unless he's really seems to be having a crisis, don't push him and don't jump, and you will be able to let this happen on his clock in his way. And in fact, that's the way that happened. That's the way that it happened with us at home. The other people might feel that confrontation is the best way to go. You know, ultimately, this whole book boils down to Dr. Spock's advice decades ago, which is trust yourself. You know more than you think you do. You know, this is your kid, and you've got a feel for what he, what she needs. And so trust yourself.
Well, John, this is a fascinating story. We could go on and on, but unfortunately we have to go. John Schwartz, author of Oddly Normal, thanks so much for sharing your story with the Two Boomer Babes.
Oh, thanks. You guys are great.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Up next, the science and art of election prediction. We'll be right back after the break.
Kathy, remember way, way back when we were in elementary school, kids were really into baseball cards and maybe hula hoops. But did you know any kid who was obsessed with politics and could name every congressional district and all 435 representatives?
No, I really didn't hang around with anyone like that.
I guess I didn't either. And we both didn't go to school with anybody like David Wasserman. He's the editor with the nonpartisan Cook Political Report. For the past three election cycles, Dave has projected the House races for NBC News. He's come up with a rather unique way of predicting election outcomes with some pretty amazing results. Welcome to Two Boomer Babes, Dave.
Well, thanks, boomers. You're far too kind.
Dave, you're not quite 30. I believe you're 28, you little whippersnapper, you. You've gained national audience for your spot on election number crunching, and you're calling House races for NBC News. Are you really living the dream, you know, at least of a political geek?
Well, you know, Kathy, you know how some kids love to go to space camp when they're young and they dream of working at NASA Mission Control?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think there was a C-SPAN camp when I was young, but it was kind of the equivalent. The first time I stepped into the NBC decision desk in 2008, it was kind of the equivalent for me of stepping into NASA Mission Control. There are huge monitors everywhere, huge statistical graphs, and all kinds of models. And I don't mean Victoria's Secret. There are data geeks everywhere looking at these different exit poll models, real vote models, geographical models, prior vote models, and it's an election geek's dream come true.
And to you, probably just as sexy, if not more so, than a Victoria's Secret model.
Oh, absolutely, except, you know, I didn't know any girls in school growing up that wanted to talk politics with me, so
it's not exactly a babe magnet.
Yeah,
Dave. So tell us, what's it like behind the scenes on election night? Is it a real pressure cooker? I can't even imagine.
You kind of have to be there. For me, the first time I stepped into the desk and realized that NBC was compressing all of this data that they were gathering in exit polls and real votes into real-time decision-making, it really was something that we had to rehearse. And NBC goes through extensive rehearsals before election night. Actually, there's a representative from every network that's in a quarantine room gathering exit polls all day. And they're released at 5 p.m., briefcase in hand, to go back to the networks to brief the decision desk staff and the network talent on what the exit polls are showing before the polls close, to brief them on the possible scenarios. Now, prior to poll closing time, The emphasis is really on caution and getting everything right, making sure that everything is 100% certain, because every network is very fearful of repeating the 2000 debacle, which was about six beer goggles ugly. So after the polls close, the atmosphere changes a little bit, and it definitely becomes more frenetic. And there is someone whose job it is to monitor what other networks are doing and what they're deciding on the calls in the election. So, for example, in this past election, there was quite a bit of tension as to when to call the presidential race. And at 11 p.m., the decision desk at NBC at 30 Rock, we were comfortable with making the projection that Barack Obama was going to take Ohio and with it the Electoral College. Personally, I thought that Virginia was a little bit more ready to call. But we come together as a team and make these decisions. And fortunately, we were not only right, we were the first network to get it right.
Did you know way before that that Obama won?
Based on the early returns, everything seemed to point towards it. You know, my personal bellwether, and this isn't by any means scientific, but historical, going back to 1956, there's only one county in the entire country out of more than 3,100 that has correctly predicted the winner of every presidential election. It's Vigo County, Indiana, for anyone who's ever been to Terre Haute. And Vigo County in 2012, when we were analyzing the results very early on in the night, it was seesawing back and forth between Obama and Romney. But by about 8:30 p.m., when the entire county's precincts had reported, Obama was ahead by a couple hundred votes out of about 40,000. And that, to me, told us that it was probably Obama's to lose.
But Dave, let me ask you about that, because how certain do you have to be to call a race? I mean, I'm always amazed when a winner's called with a very small percentage of the votes tallied. You know, you look on the screen on election night and there's like 2%.
Yeah.
How can they possibly call the election based on that?
Well, my job is to keep track of what's going on in House races. And at least for me, what I do is keep track of a large database of prior election results so that if we see a certain number of counties reporting in, even if not even 25% of the vote has come in, and we see that they're tracking above or below how they've performed for different parties in the past, we can be reasonably confident as to how the rest of the counties are going to vote and possibly make a projection. And that goes into a very complex statistical model at the presidential level.
What about exit polls? You know, again, Barbara, as she was saying, you know, that they come up with these very early numbers. Are they really predictive? I mean, I don't know. I've never, first of all, had anybody ask me when I walked out of a poll. I don't know about you, Barb. And with all the cell phones and early voting, doesn't it really add just a complexity that's very unknown?
I think exit polling is getting to be a more challenging endeavor for all kinds of news outlets. The reason is that more and more voters are voting early, and they're voting absentee. And so if you're taking a sample of voters coming out of a voting precinct on election day, you're not really getting a complete sample. And the question is, how do you weight the exit poll to take into account those who aren't showing up on election day? Because our elections aren't one-day clearance sales anymore. They're more like month-long events, or even more. It's been a real challenge to calibrate polling both prior to the election and in an exit poll to get this right, because early voters in person tend to vote for Democrats. Absentee voters these days are voting more Republican.
We're talking with David Wasserman, the House editor of the Cook Political Report, about the science and art of predicting elections. Now, Dave, you were just talking about early voting. What's the likelihood of vote tampering with early voting?
Well, I think, Barb, that most of the conspiracy theories out there on election rigging by calibrating voting machines to cast votes for certain candidates over others belong in the same garbage bin as the conspiracy theories about Obama being born in Kenya. And so really, the most tense moment for me on an election night decision desk hasn't revolved around the security of voting booths. But I'll tell you about a moment in 2010 when the outcome in the House was particularly in some doubt because there was a chance that Republicans were going to take over the House. And in fact, they did. And when I was going through our model at about 8:15 p.m. on election night, I was reasonably sure that Republicans were overperforming the model and that they were going to take back control of the House. And I put in the call to the network that Republicans had the seats they needed to do so. A couple minutes later, Steve Kappas, the head of NBC News, came down from his office. He was armed with a team of lawyers because the network wants to make absolutely sure that the decision desk is absolutely right. He basically laid down the law and said, you know, we're not going to announce this for 45 more minutes until 9 p.m. because Nancy Pelosi just called the speaker and she wants to make sure we don't announce anything before the polls close in her home state of California. And so in those 45 minutes before the network called the outcome of the House, I was very nervous that another network was going to beat us to it. Fortunately, when Brian Williams came on air at 9 p.m. and called the House for Republicans, we were still the first. But it can get dicey, and I think it has more to do with the ambivalence of networks, wariness of repeating mistakes from 2000 rather than anything to do with tampering of voting booths or ballots.
Now, Dave, we would be absolutely remiss if we didn't ask you about your rather unusual way of predicting how people will vote based on how we eat, which has gained a lot of attention. You've gotten a lot of followers for that one. How did you come up with it?
We talk about how we're polarized in every way as a nation, how we're polarized racially, economically, generationally, along gender lines. But above all else, I think when it comes down to our voting habits, we're divided by culture. And the problem is, how do you quantify that? And so I devised a new method of quantifying the culture gap in American politics. I used a Google mapping application to plot out all chain retail locations of any kind with at least 100 locations in at least 40 states. And the goal was to identify which chain best predicted where Republicans live and vote, and which chain predicted where Democrats are gaining strength politically. What I came up with was that in 2008, Barack Obama won 80% of counties with a Whole Foods market, but just 36% of counties with a Cracker Barrel Old Country store, which was the largest gap that we've seen since 1992. And in fact, a lot of people were saying, well, the culture gap can't possibly get wider in 2012. As a matter of fact, Barack Obama won 77% of counties with a Whole Foods market and just 29% of counties with a Cracker Barrel Old Country store, which is a 48% gap, 4 points even wider than it was in 2008. So I think culture is really becoming the best predictor of voting patterns and our polarization as a country.
I tell you, this is really thinking outside the box. Dave, you've also become a one-man clearinghouse for election tabulations across the country. Tell us about, very quickly because we're almost out of time, your voter spreadsheet, which has developed an almost cult-like following.
Well, for those who can't get enough of election night, what I decided to do was maintain a spreadsheet of election returns as they were coming in, because the dirty little secret is that the vote tally reported on election night isn't anywhere near the final result. In fact, Obama's lead grew by several million votes after election night. So had he been behind on election night, he probably would have been ahead a month later. Of course, it wasn't exactly that close. But I was talking with Nate Silver, who runs the 538 blog at the New York Times, the night before the election. And for all the statistical models that he has, which I think are fantastic, the one thing he was lamenting was that at the New York Times, they don't really have an election night system of tallying votes. As a matter of fact, the AP stopped counting votes a couple days after the election, and so the spreadsheet, which you can find on cookpolitical.com, is really something that junkies are glued to, even as the final results are coming in more than a month after the election.
So just tell us real quickly, what percentage is the president ahead by at this point?
Well, the president is ending up, it looks like, with 51.06% of the popular vote, to 47.21% for Romney. So that would be a 3.85% spread, almost 5 million vote spread between the two candidates. Of course, Democrats love to point out the irony of Mitt Romney, who ended up getting 47% of the vote. Well, you know, if you talk about how 47% of voters are simply living off the government, be careful. You might just end up with them.
Dave Wasserman, House Editor of the Cook Political Report and guru of election predictions, thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thanks, Barb and Kathy.
Up next, traveling with our pampered pets. It's now a whole lot easier and more luxurious. We'll be right back after the break.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Thank you.
Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is the news. This morning, we are saluting the 2.2 million women who have joined in the war effort. They now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
The prestigious Harvard Medical School is breaking ground today, opening its doors to new female applicants.
Today, little girls all over the world look to the sky, where the first woman is now in space.
Military stereotypes are challenged today with the trailblazing promotion of a U.S. female officer to four-star general. It was just announced that the vast majority of last year's doctorate degrees were earned by women.
We've come so far, but our news is changing for the worse. More women die from heart disease and stroke than men, even though it can be prevented. Make a change at GoRedForWomen.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, aunt, son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save...
Your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. S, speech difficulty. T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment, and that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of...
Your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate... Mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
It used to be that pet owners who wanted to go on vacation were in a bind. What to do with Fido? The options? The expensive kennel, the hard-to-find house sitter, or the hotel which allowed pets, but not exactly the Ritz. Well, these days, traveling with pets is a whole lot easier and more luxurious. That's because many top hotels are now putting out the welcome mat.
Today, we're shooting the breeze with Bob Vetteri, president of the American Pet Products Association. He joins us in our Washington, D.C. studios to talk about this growing phenomenon. Delighted to have you on the show, Bob.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
How do you explain this growing trend, Bob?
That's the biggest part of it. And so much of that comes from the fact that, you know, as boomers, our children are now growing up. They're getting married. They're going to school. They're leaving the house. What were we called? Helicopter parents. We used to hover over the kids. Now we're looking to hover over our pets, and there they are waiting for us.
You know, it was really surprising to read about the list of luxury hotels that cater to pets these days. So tell us about a few of them.
Well, everything from the W's, the whole Starwood chain, the Marriott's are becoming more and more like that now. And each one is a little bit different. The Marriott down in Palm Springs had a special bowl, a special bed, a special feeding tray, and special treats. I mean, these were really good,
really
delicious
pets.
Treats. Yes.
Well, I hope they deflee the bedrooms after the pet leaves.
They do, although the way some of the pets come in, they're just quite impressive.
They're probably more coiffed than we ever
they
would be.
They probably are. Hope to be. Yeah.
So, and when we say cater, we really mean cater. Tell us about some of these unbelievable spa treatments that are available for pets.
You would think it would be just the nails or the paws. No, it goes way beyond that. The treatments for hair, for the cleaning, for the, as you say, coiff them just beyond belief. The walking They have special walking areas that they take them to that you would be proud to walk along some of these pathways.
We want to re-landscape our backyard to envy.
Seriously.
And it was the blueberry facials that got me.
Yes. I'm not sure I would go for some of these, but the pets would. And the treatment for teeth and the like, just phenomenal.
Well, what about spa robes and little paw slippers?
My son has spa robes for both of his French bulldogs.
Oh, my God.
We were just kidding.
Yeah,
we
were.
Oh, no.
Now, how does pets stay calm for these treatments? I mean, are they muzzled? Or are they possibly drugged?
Barbara, if you
Vanek?
Were being massaged and had blueberry that stuff honey, all over your
poodle.
Face, I mean, my God.
That's the one thing you have to caution people about. Most pets are going to handle this well. Most dogs are going to handle it well. You have to be sure that your pet's okay with that kind of handling, fondling, and everything. You'd be surprised if it's done right. Most pets will take to it.
Bob, how much do these treatments cost?
Yeah, well, they...
An arm and a leg, an arm and a paw.
They will run from the reasonable to the holy cow. They could go up to
$300. $300?
$300 for a complete treatment for a day, for being walked, groomed, spa treatments, the blueberry facials, and the like.
Why,
working
gosh.
Yeah, that, I've heard them as high as $300. I mean, most of them are like $25 to $30 to $40, but you get to a really high-end hotel, and it mimics human treatments. I mean, the same people are making the decision to have these, so they put it all in human terms. They humanize their pet. It's a very comparable package.
And do the hotels, do they charge extra to have your pet?
Sure. Yeah, but they'll also have pet sitters, pet walkers. Well, people can take their pet with them on a business trip. Leave the pet in the room, but the hotel will see to it that they're walked, that they're fed, that they've taken out to bathe, and also give them a spa treatment.
Barbara,
if you throw it in.
Whole package, Kathy.
If this doesn't work out, you know, two boomer babes, we might think of a pet spa.
Hey, maybe we could pass. Who knows?
Let me in on that when you decide.
Okay, we will.
Okay, we'll keep you posted. Well, Bob Vetteri, president of the American Pet Products Association, thanks so much for joining the two boomer babes, and
I think we ought to go book a room, don't you?
Thank you again for having me. I appreciate it.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Do you ever wake up in the middle of the night and wonder, what's the difference between a Pinot Noir and a Pinotage? Or which wines pair nicely with spicy foods or chocolate? Heck, it's much better than mentally putting together your grocery list at 3 a.m.
Melanie Wagner is a certified sommelier and author of Hello Wine. She joins us on the phone from chilly Chicago to talk all things vino, one of our favorite topics. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
One of the most difficult things for me is to try to figure out which wines that I should serve with all these gourmet meals that I whip up all the time. And Barbara's kind of smiling over there. But anyway, if I was whipping up gourmet meals, are there any universal rights and wrongs when it comes to food and wine pairings?
I'm glad you asked that question. There's a lot of information about food and wine and how they're meant to be together. So I would say kind of know yourself, know your audience as maybe the first universal law. And then second, I would say is try to match the intensity of the food and wine. If you've got a really, really intense food like barbecue short ribs and you pair them with a delicate wine, you're going to clobber that wine and vice versa.
So are you suggesting that we shouldn't serve our Asti Spumante with our pot roast?
Probably not.
No.
if you love it, then you should do what you like. A lot of what I do in Hello Wine is confidence building, I think. I like to think of myself more kind of as a wine coach than a wine teacher necessarily.
So say we're serving cheese for appetizers. I mean, we're really, really going out on a limb here.
Mm-hmm.
Is it better to go with white or red or both?
I always say both. But if you had to choose one or the other, whites generally are a little more food-friendly, and that's cheese-friendly, too. If you get a nice, bright, crisp white wine, like Pinot Grigio or some of the whites, Chardonnays from Burgundy, France, that are just kind of crisp and clean, or Sauvignon Blancs, those are really nice wines that don't have a lot of oak and butter flavor, and they pretty much will go with most cheeses.
Well, Melanie, I have to say, it was a real buzzkill to read that wine plus chocolate does not equal heaven. I mean, in fact, you say the most chocolate and wine pairings are really pretty awful. So
well,
what
yeah,
goes well?
I know. I'm sorry to be the bearer of that bad news, but there is a light at the end of the tunnel, because I know so many people are interested in pairing chocolate with wine, and I love both of those things. Believe me, I'm not an official expert on chocolate, but I've had enough to feel like I can talk about it in a very educated way. I think the one thing you have to remember with pairing wine with chocolate, if you want a really great experience, is to make sure that the wine is at least as ripe and sweet tasting as the chocolate is. And that actually goes for all desserts, not just chocolate. So I try to say, if you can, lean toward the darkest chocolate, a chocolate with a cocoa count of, like, you know, 60% or more. That's great, because it won't be too sweet. And then try to get your wine as ripe as you can. Even wines that have a little bit of sweetness to them, like ports, are awesome with chocolate, because if the wine is too dry and the chocolate's too sweet, like a milk chocolate, you're basically, the sugar is going to kind of cancel out a lot of flavor in the wine, and the wine won't taste as good as it possibly could.
Oh, gosh, I just can't wait to have a dinner party. Okay, so finally, Barb and I are huge fans of box wines.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us, are there any great recommendations for a good box wine? And, of course, we're willing to pay up to $15.
I'll do 10, Kathy.
It's kind of funny. I actually did blog recently. I read a blog, MelanieWagnerWine.com, and one of my first blog entries a couple years ago was this boxed wine experiment. And I was actually going to include it in the book, because I wanted to say that super premium wines were starting to go into boxes. I think that we're headed that way. But what I found in my experimentation is not a lot of people are putting super high quality wines into boxes yet. But I did find some really great values, and I think the box is an amazing way to store wine and keep it fresh for a long time.
Oh, for like 350 years. Can't get better than that.
So what's your top pick?
There was a Red Truck red wine that was in a box that I really, I thought was great. There's starting to be a lot more options, though, definitely. At one time I think I had like 50 boxed wines in my living room, just hanging out waiting to be tasted.
Oh, heck, we want to come up
when that happens. We are so sophisticated.
We are.
Wine expert Melanie Wagner, author of Hello Wine. Thanks so much for sharing these fabulous wine tips with the two Boomer Babes.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers to you.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zymer Communications.
How long have you all known each other?
To put it in perspective, it was 23 years ago. I was counting when I couldn't go back to sleep in the morning.
I like it that she thinks about how long we've known each other when she's not sleeping.
Really?